Welcome, class.
It's Professor Davis.
This is the third session of our course, American Visionary Poetry. We're pleased to be able to look at some exemplary American poets and approach poetry as a vehicle towards visionary experience, towards spiritual understanding, and towards a kind of evanescent truth. Because, let's face it, we're all moderns here. We don't have access to the easy fairy tales that have previously organized the questions of death, the questions of the beyond. And so we're left kind of on our own. And in my personal experience, poetry, and particularly the poetry of Wallace Stevens, as well as a handful of other great American poets that we'll be studying in this course, Whitman, Ginsberg, Gary Snyder, Dale Pendle, that these poems become an opportunity to really wrestle with one's own spiritual experience and the difficulty in turning that into an expression, into a form of art, into a form of communication. And in my experience, the poetry of Wallace Stevens, which I'll speak a little bit about him in a second, has been a constant touchstone, something that I've returned to again and again since I first discovered him in my undergraduate years at Yale. Now, what do we mean by spiritual experience? I don't usually tell this story, even to some of my good friends don't know this, but I have been blessed with having a mystical experience unaided by any psychoactive substance. And it happened in an amusing enough way at a Zen temple. So I was studying there during a practice period, and this is so Zen, it's funny, it's a joke. I was washing beets in the garden by myself. Huh. You know, these muddy beets, running them through the water. And then something happened. And the best way I can describe it was, imagine you had a sort of telescope and it's all collapsed. And you know, you can look through your eyepiece, and then there's the other side. And the other side, the outside, is the world. And this inner piece is your eye, this ghost of a self that seems to be moving through this world. And it was as if suddenly this telescope was infinitely elongated, so that I was aware, and I was, the watcher of the watcher of the watcher of the watcher of the watcher, all the way up into the crystal resonant empyrean, a kind of angelic, impersonal overmind that was me and yet had nothing to do with my conventional personality. This lasted about, I would say, 10 seconds. And then what preceded it was a kind of return to the world, when I sort of looked up and once again recognized that I was in space and time, and that this crystalline consciousness was somehow involved and embedded in this flow. And what I saw was perfectly lawful. And I don't usually use that word, lawful, but everything was proceeding as it must, as it should, as it would, as it needed to, and there was a sense of just infinite necessity and goodness in that necessity. It was a kind of great symphony, and I saw in that moment that suffering arises because this little crystal of angelic intelligence, this Gnostic flash, is somehow gets concerned as it becomes embedded in space-time and grasps and holds. And I saw that truth very clearly, and that probably lasted about 2 or 3 minutes with kind of a diminution into a more sort of psychedelic perception of the glorious symphony of sensorial reality, the flows of space and time. It was like suddenly seeing, having a glimpse of the all, but realizing that it doesn't stop. It just keeps flowing. And in that flow, it fades. And there you are again, you, the little you, grasping, wondering, what was that? So the poetry we're reading and reciting today and discussing in some ways circles around that question, or aspects of that question, but it also reflects on the question of how you can approach such things, not through religion, not through mysticism, not through spiritual practice, not through seeing gurus, but through poetry, through reading and understanding great poets. And there is such a thing as great poets. So a little bit about Wallace Stevens. Wallace Stevens led an extraordinarily straight and boring life. He is the most boring of the people that we will be studying in this class. He was he worked in the insurance industry. He was a suit businessman, worked in Hartford, Connecticut, and wrote his poems often to and fro work. And so for him, poetry had nothing to do with an engagement with social reality, that instead it was a kind of spiritual quest, a kind of meditative exploration. And just a tad about his early verse, we'll be only discussing some later poems today. His early verse is represented by an extraordinary, almost surrealist exuberance in language and in nature, in physical reality, in sensibility. Last week we talked about Emerson and the role of nature in the sort of Gnostic consciousness of American sort of informal spirituality. And in many ways, Stevens carries that forward with his almost pagan embrace of nature, which sometimes takes an explicitly anti-Christian form. In many ways, he's informed by the kinds of ideas. Sunday morning is very explicitly a questioning of the notion of immortality. In Stevens' view, it is a kind of Buddhist world where the things are always flowing and we cannot really say what happens when we too fall off the cliff. But we'll be talking and focusing on some later poems. And the first is the first two stanzas of a poem called Primitive Like an Orb. And this is a very good expression of just how mystic he can go. Because while, and one little trick, a little clue to Stevens, is that like a lot of great modernists, because he is in some ways the great American modernist poet, along with William Carlos Williams and others.
Name again?
William Carlos Williams. I lost my thread. Modernist, yes, is that there's a great deal of reflection on the act of poetry itself, on the making of the thing. There's a self-awareness about the form of writing and the games that writing and language have. It's not a transparent discourse. But when he reflects on poems in his poems, he's also reflecting on spiritual experience, and that's a kind of secret key. So the first stanza from Primitive Like an Orb goes, if I can remember it. The essential poem at the center of things, the arias that spiritual fiddlings make, have gorged the cast iron of our lives with good and the cast iron of our works. But it is, dear sirs, a difficult apperception, this gorging good, fetched by such slick-eyed nymphs, this essential gold, this fortune's finding, disposed and redisposed by such slight genii in such pale air. And my good friend Brooke will be reciting the second stanza.
We do not prove the existence of the poem. It is something seen and known in lesser poems. It is the huge high harmony that sounds a little and a little by means of a separate sense. It is and it is not, and therefore is. The breadth of an accelerando moves, captives the being, widens, and was there. That second stanza of A Primitive Like an Orb is, in my mind, one of the most spiritual, if you want to use that word, expressions of writing anywhere. It is that experience, like Marx's experience of watching the soul move from the death of his friend, or Eric's experience with the beats, It is the experience of a moment. It is the flash. It's there. It is, when Wallace talks about the poem, for him it is one way of saying the ineffable. He talks a lot about ordering. And for him, the poem is a way of saying the thing. And the encounter with whatever the ineffable is that thing where it's there. It seizes you. It possesses you. You are expanded. It's gone.
And so we're passing around copies. I don't know if we have quite enough. I just want to make just a few comments about this particular poem and before we go on to something else. What, one of the lines that's great is the arias that spiritual fiddlings make, because in many ways, that's what we're up to. That's what we do in our sort of wayward, mix and match, half in ignorance, half in hunger quest for some kind of spiritual substance, some this gorging good he describes. And so these are mere fiddling. This isn't some great symphony. We're not involved in some perfect religious practice. And yet the arias, that is the peaks of expression that can emerge from this practice, have in them the trace, the sort of noetic or Gnostic trace of these deeper kinds of experiences. And it is this that fills our lives with good and the cast iron, just the mere work of our words. Yes, Dale?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of echoes. I think he had John Dryden in mind, this Ode to St. Cecilia's Day. Arise, Lord, and dance. The diapason building.
Yes, the echo, and that's another thing about Stevens, is that Stevens, like many poets, but in my experience more closely, is that he's an introduction to the way that poems talk to other poems and poets talk to other poets. And we'll talk about that a little bit at the end. And what you get from that is this kind of conversation, this kind of resonant conversation. I mean, I've had that experience many times in visionary states where fragments of poems will arise again, and you somehow, at the same time, speak them as if they're your own, and recognize the way that they are to a transmission. And these kinds of transmissions are enriching the thing. And then finally, there's a little reference, there's a kind of reference or a gesture to the imagination, because this is a sort of tricky bit, is that when we try to grasp these experiences, or oftentimes the way these experiences come, is they come clothed in the imagination, in experiences of angels, in dreams of gods, in haunted landscapes, in places where the sort of richness of the imagination, that locus somewhere between dreaming and fantasy and myth and comic books and psychedelic imagery, somewhere in there is this kind of imagination machine. But Stevens is too wise and too sober and perhaps a bit melancholic to be able to embrace these angels in any kind of easy sense. That is why they are mere slick-eyed nymphs, slight genii. And when he says such slight genii in such pale air, this air will come back a little bit later. It's the air of speech, the air of language. So that's what I really wanted to establish here, is this notion of essential gold, the kind of Gnostic insight, and the ways in which that gets played out in poetry. And now, well, we're going to turn to probably Stevens' most famous poem, which I'm really happy to say we'll be able to hear from Brooke, who I've had the opportunity to hear many times recite this poem, and we'll just go into it. The Idea of Order at Key West.
So, you folks may have to forgive me. I may have to peek. I haven't said this poem much for a long time, and memorizing poetry is my hobby, but I usually only say it to myself, so it's pretty rare to say it to such a gathering. So I may have to peek, but I'll stand and I'll give it a shot. She sang beyond the genius of the sea. The water never formed to mind or voice. Like a body, holy body, fluttering its empty sleeves. and yet its mimic motion made constant cry, caused constantly a cry which was not ours, although we understood. Inhuman, of the veritable ocean. The sea was not a mask, no more was she. The song and the water were not Mez's sounds. Even if what she sang was what she heard, and what she sang was uttered word by word, it may be that in all her phrases stirred the grinding water and the gasping wind. But it was she, and not the sea, we heard. For she was the maker of the song she sang. The ever-hooded, tragic-gestured sea was merely the place by which she walked to sing. Whose spirit is this, we said, because we knew it was the spirit that we sought, and knew that we should ask as often as she sang. If it was only the dark voice of the sea that rose, or even colored by many waves, if it was only the outer voice of sky and cloud, of the sunken coral water walls, however clear, it would have been deep air, the heaving speech of air, a summer sound, repeated in a summer without end, and sound alone. But it was more than that, more even than her voice and ours, among the meaningless plungings of water and the wind, theatrical distances, bronze shadows heaped on high horizons, mountainous atmospheres of sky and sea. It was her voice that made the sky acutest at its vanishing. She measured to the hour its solitude. She was the single artificer of the world in which she sang. And when she sang, the sea, whatever self it had, became the self that was her song, for she was the maker. Then we, as we beheld her striding there alone, knew there never was a world for her except the one she sang, and singing made. Ramon Fernandez, tell me, if you know, why when the singing ended and we turned toward the town, tell why the lights of the fishing boats in the harbor there, as the night descended, tilting in the air, mastered the night and portioned out the sea, fixing fiery zones and emblazoned poles, arranging, deepening, enhancing night. Oh, blessed rage for order, pale Ramon. The rage of the maker to order words of the sea and of the fragrant portals dimly starred, and of ourselves and of our origins in ghostlier demarcations, keener sounds.
Thank you. Woo! Woo! All right, I'm passing this out.
I will say one thing about that poem,
please,
actually.
Please.
It's a sort of a sweet aside, but I memorized that poem almost 14 years ago, the first time that my beloved spouse and I had a fight. Memorizing poetry is my hobby, and in some way I wanted to mark the event. And it was a poem that we both loved, and so I learned it.
So this is one I've returned to often as if it were a koan or a spiritual teaching in itself. And in poetic terms, what lurks behind it is something known as the pathetic fallacy. And this is something in poetry that designates a very common form of poetry in the early, up before the 20th century, of addressing or invoking nature as if nature was a spirit that could speak. Now this should probably hit many of us pretty deep, because I suspect that a lot of people here have both a longing and perhaps an experience of communicating or seeming to communicate with nature in whatever form, a being, a spirit, a figment of the imagination, a sense of the landscape, a sense of the flows of water and wind and plants and beasts and the great whirling cosmos that seems to threaten us with its emptiness and its coldness. But here Stevens is doing something very modern. He's swerving a bit from this possibility, in many ways a very satisfying possibility, that we can just hear immediately nature's voice. So a lot of the poem is built on this balance between the poet, the singer, us, our imaginations, our ability to organize reality, and reality itself. And he acknowledges this gap, this little chiasmos, this little split where something different happens. And it really struck me because after a couple of years, I finally went to my Zen master at the time. I no longer have a Zen master. And I told him about my experience with the beats, because I knew that it would be uncool to say it right away, like, hey, I had this experience, you know, because he'd trash it. You know, that's what Zen masters do. And it was interesting, and he sort of goes, okay, but did you see the way that the self you perceive, that crystalline intelligence, the watcher of the watcher of the watcher, was the same thing as the flow of the forces, the wind and the flow of action that I also saw? And I was like, no, they seem different to me. They seem distinct, that there was something distinctly different about this noetic spark and then the world in which it finds itself. And that's much of what he's doing in here, is this question of, is the sea singing, or is she singing and bringing the sea to life through her song? Is it really just us in our imaginings, in our art, that can give voice and complement nature, rather than simply being a kind of shamanic or transparent vehicle for nature's voice? And in a way, it's the kind of mind that we sort of want to get away from. We can sort of see the way that part of what constitutes modern civilization, modernity, of the age of science and technology, and this tremendous explosive novelty in the development of social situations and literature and art and mathematics, that there's something in there that's driven by this gap. And we have this desire in some ways to reunify, to be able to be there, to have the poem and the sea resonating at one. But where Stevens stands is on the just at the edge of that gap, where it seems to flash, the possibility remains open, and yet it's ultimately forestalled. It's ultimately kept in bay. But it's not that we're just alone here, you know, making things up. There's that great bit. When she sang, the sea, whatever self it had, became the self that was her song, for she was the maker. Now this is probably a little uncomfortable, because I suspect that many people here, you know, have some sense that in the biblical tradition, you know, God gives Adam the speech of the power of naming, and that in naming nature, in some sense, we bring it alive, the sense that we humans are the makers of this world we find ourselves in. And once again, a little resistant about that. That can definitely go too far. But this is a much deeper kind of making. It's a kind of communion, but one that does not dissolve into this kind of this unity consciousness that in other ways we can very much be attracted to and can deeply experience. The sort of the bit of the poem that I want to say here, just because of the Black Rock City, is this point where he's facing the sea and he's seeing this being who's mediating, this poetic mediation between the sea and her own poetic inspiration, or the poetic inspiration of the world. And then there's this turn, Ramon Fernandez, tell me if you know, why when the singing ended and we turned toward the town, tile why the glassy lights, the lights in the fishing boats that anchored there as the night descended, tilting in the air, mastered the night and portioned out the sea, fixing emblazoned zones and fiery poles, arranging, deepening, enchanting night. And this comes to me here because this is a very strange conjunction, Black Rock City, Burning Man, of a very direct and, you know, inarguable encounter with nature, and yet a condition which manifests and intensifies our particular and peculiar human inventiveness, our rage to order, but order in a peculiar way. When I look at the playa at night, I see those fishing boats organizing, arranging night. We guide ourselves through the nightscape, through these little bits of light that form shapes or images that we recognize. And that becomes a way of a kind of mastery, a kind of ordering. Not an overbearing mastery, but a kind of mental affirmation, a linguistic affirmation, that there is something in language, even if it separates from the thing it names, that there's something creative, organizing, and in some ways transcendent about that activity. And it is that rage that he's really trying to hone in on. And I just wanted to note as well the repetition of this question of air. He says, if it was only the dark voice of the sea that rose, meaning if we were only actually hearing nature itself, it would have been deep air, the heaving speech of air, an expression of the element. But it was more than that. But he doesn't say what that more is. You know, perhaps a Christian would say, ah, that is because we are ensouled by God and nature is this kind of trap, or it's kind of a messy thing, or it's maybe something that's here for our own benefit. But that's not what he's pointing to. He's trying to organize that specific sense of consciousness of mind that is our peculiar weave in the nature of the world. So finally, I want to talk about what is sort of seen as Stevens's last poem. I don't know for a fact if it was actually the last poem he wrote. I'm not well versed enough in his biography, but it's certainly recognized by that. And it's a very interesting poem for that because of the topic that Mark brought out, because it's a poem of death. It's a death poem. And in the Zen tradition, there's this whole idea that that just on the verge of death, the Zen master will like scribble out some, you know, zingy haiku as he stands there teetering on the edge, and that there's these collections of these Zen poems. Of course, they tend to be more composed than the mythology would have you tell, but there's something really potent about the idea of a last poem, of a death poem. And I always think about this poem when I'm out here, and I was incredibly pleased that in 2003, Beyond Belief, someone had created an art installation out on the playa dedicated to this poem with the words on it in sort of a beautiful, delicate flowery array. So this is called Of Mere Being. The palm at the end of the mind, beyond the last thought, rises in the bronze decor. A gold-feathered bird sings in the palm, without human meaning, without human feeling, a foreign song. You know then that it is not the reason that makes us happy or unhappy. The bird sings, its feathers shine. The palm stands on the edge of space. The wind moves slowly through the branches. The bird's fire-fangled feathers dangle down. And in the handout there, you'll see a little bit of, and I'll just really briefly touch on this because I know we're winding down. Just an instance of the way that here, even at this moment, beyond the last thought, on the lip of death, Stevens is talking to other poets, but he's talking about them about this question of whether our artificing, whether that extra creativity we bring, whether our ability to build these cathedrals, whether they're literal cathedrals or cathedrals of ideas, of language, of sensibility, whether there is something in that that remains, something in that that can master death, that can take us beyond. And one of the things that he's referencing with this bird, is this bird a natural bird? or is it an artificial bird? It is a golden bird, that golden essence that he talked about in Primitive Like an Orb. And in this very famous Yeats poem, Yeats is one of the greats that Stevens was speaking most directly to, there is this idea of being able to overcome death through the act of artifice, through a kind of invention. But it's a question. It's not a belief. And the poem is very much about being old. Yeats's poem about being old. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing for every tatter in its mortal dress. So he's feeling his age here, and he's thinking about this notion of a kind of what he calls the artifice of eternity. It's an amazing phrase, the artifice of eternity, because on the one hand it means our ability to build a framework that might actually create the context for some kind of survival, some kind of abiding, but it's the artifice. We can't really escape the sense that it's merely a construction, like these magical things we see at night here. Some marvelous leap of the imagination runs across our mind and we hustle up to it. We want to get closer and closer to some fabulous creature or, you know, dancing lights, and then we get up there and it's a bunch of 2x4s and a generator and it's stuck together with tape and we're like, what was that? You know, that in some sense is the artifice of eternity. So this notion of gold, this notion of artifice is going on in Of Mere Being. And he talks in there about a bird, this bird in the court of in Byzantium. And what this, and I'll read the stanza. Once out of nature, I shall never take my bodily form from any natural thing, but such a form as Grecian goldsmiths make of hammered gold and gold enameling to keep a drowsy emperor awake, or set upon a golden bough to sing to lords and ladies of Byzantium of what is past or passing or to come. And this reference to a golden bird in Byzantium refers to an actual automaton that was famous throughout the world. It was the 12th, 13th century, and it was this. There were tons of automata back in those days, and it was this marvelous bird that could express all of these fabulous things, and yet it was a machine. So it asked this question, this sense of, is the machine the artifice of ourselves? Is that our bodily form outside of nature? And of course, Yeats leaves the question open, as does Stevens. So when he talks about the bird, it's not clear whether he's talking about a sort of glowing essence of nature or something of the human imagination, something of the artifice that we weave. Because this bird sings in the poem without human meaning, without human feeling, that's that same sense that you had in the idea of order, that nature is ultimately mute. The poem stands on the edge of space. The wind moves slowly in the branches. The bird's fire-fangled feathers dangle down, downward. Downward into darkness, as one of his early poems had it. And it is that thusness, just the passing moment of that sensation, that is all that he can finally reside in. And that's a sort of stoic lesson. It's a slightly bitter one, and yet it has this tremendous imaginative power that is well worth imbibing. And I hope I have seduced you a bit into the poetry of Wallace Stevens. But thank you very much for your attention. Really?